Welcome to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. I'm Russ White. At 6 past the hour following the latest news, a pro-trade conversation you likely haven't heard this election season.
It's important that we recognize that those potential trade agreements do present opportunity, and hopefully this rhetoric that's been in the campaign season at virtually every level of the campaign can be put on the shelf when we can go back to talking about doing business.
Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis will introduce you to the new dean of the MSU College of Law, Larry Ponneroff.
I think we've only begun to scratch the surface in terms of really leveraging the MSU brand.
That and more begins at 4:06. Tune to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
International trade deals have been much maligned in the rhetoric of this presidential election, and according to Michigan agricultural leaders, most unfairly and irresponsibly maligned. With us to talk trade and representing the agricultural leaders of Michigan are Sam Hines, Executive Vice President of the Michigan Pork Producers Association, and Jim Byram, President of the Michigan Agribusiness Association. Jim, let's start with you, a little historical perspective. Let's go back to 1994. NAFTA was launched. What has that trade deal meant for Michigan agriculture?
Well, it's ironic here. Just 2 or 3 weeks ago, I was in Mexico City, and we had the opportunity to interact with several folks that we've been doing business with for a long time. In fact, interestingly enough, about 20 years. Might date back to NAFTA, may even go a little bit before that, but the relationship we have with Mexican buyers in a variety of commodities that we deal with in the state of Michigan is pretty intense and pretty profound. If we didn't have that Mexican market, we wouldn't see current grower prices where they're at for many of Michigan's commodities. That's a significant point. Secondly, the other trade agreements that we see around the world that we're even considering, those present opportunities that we don't currently have available. It's important that we recognize that those potential trade agreements do present opportunity, and hopefully this rhetoric that's been in the campaign season at virtually every level of the campaign can be put on the shelf when we can go back to talking about doing business.
It's interesting to note that prior to NAFTA, the pork industry, actually, we saw a net import of pork into the U.S., and it started things going the other way. And ever since then, we've been a net exporter. In fact, the volume of pork exports are up 1,550% since NAFTA was implemented. So it's been phenomenal. We're actually exporting about one out of every four hogs produced in the U.S.
You know, it's interesting with the rhetoric that we've been talking about. I mean, all of these debates seem to be framed with respect to manufacturing jobs. Seldom is agricultural mentioned in the debate. And that sort of skews things with respect to what the voting public understands.
Well, two things that I always say. One is that we do a great job in agriculture. The only thing we do a better job of is telling nobody about it. Unfortunately, exports for agriculture drive our economy. If we produce way more here than we can ever consume, we have to export. And it's true for every commodity that we produce, from pork to dry beans to apples to everything else under the sun, corn and soybeans being at the top of the list. Dairy products, huge issues. If we can't export, we lose market share and we lose future opportunities, but even beyond that, we lose current pricing, and that's a significant issue. But you're absolutely right. The rhetoric has been all about manufacturing jobs, and unfortunately, ag has been lost in the shuffle, and it's been to our detriment.
Again, going back to pork, specifically, pork is, the most consumed meat in the world. And so there's a real demand for pork out there, and the advantage that the U.S. has is that the U.S. pork producers are the least cost, or we can raise pork more efficiently here than anywhere in the world. So we have a real advantage if we can just export.
Before we skip to the new Trans-Pacific Partnership and talk a little bit about that, I mean, there's some talk about NAFTA actually being repealed or rescinded. Any chance that that's going to happen?
We certainly hope not. It would absolutely be devastating in several different respects. First, it would be devastating in our current relationships with Canada, who is one of our largest trading partners, if not the largest trading partner, with our Mexican relationships that are absolutely critical for many commodities. And finally, it would be a total destruction of our credibility as a trading partner. If we negotiate an agreement, sign an agreement, move forward with an agreement, and then all of a sudden, because of politics and political posturing, start to rescind some of those agreements, it is absolutely to our detriment, not just as an agricultural industry or manufacturing industry, but as a country and a world power.
Well, all I could say to add to that is that Mexico is actually the largest destination for pork right now, both pork variety meats and pork wholesale cuts. So it's a tremendous market for us.
Well, let's fast forward here to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, also known as TPP, also much in the news, also much maligned, and not just maligned by one party or the other, but increasingly maligned by both.
It's stunning, quite frankly, that we have built our economy based on our ability to do business around the world. And all of a sudden, the political parties, and it's not just true in the presidential campaign, but congressional campaigns, even some state legislative campaigns, which have nothing to do with trade. But it's amazing how they've attacked TPP as the boogeyman in the election, and it's going to harm all sorts of job opportunities in the United States. The irony is, the true irony, is if we're not part of the TPP, all those other countries that are engaged, that have agreed with or signed that agreement to move forward, they will form their own trade agreement and trade relationships. And it'll be us that's left out in the cold, and that's the great fear we have.
Sam, back to Jim's point about if the United States pulls out of the deal, there's a vacuum there and there's a void that will be filled. And there are other people who are already signed on to the Trans-Pacific Partnership who are going to fill that void.
Well, that's exactly right. We have to look at what we're facing there. The countries represented in that agreement represent 40% of the gross domestic product worldwide. There's a half a billion consumers in those countries. And, you know, again, looking at it from the standpoint of the pork industry, economists have evaluated that. If it's implemented, we will see an increase of 10,000 jobs directly related to pork exports. And quite frankly, they've told us it's the largest commercial opportunity ever for the pork industry. So it's critical that we get that passed.
And it's also significant to note that the Chinese are trying to establish their same kind of relationships with those same countries. It's becoming an absolute, I don't want to call it a trade war, but it's certainly a view of opportunity, and the Chinese see it as a major challenge to them, which is why they're trying to form their own agreement. It's also interesting to note right now we're looking at a Canadian-European Union trade agreement that is in the news here a couple weeks ago that actually threatens some of the things we already do. We're going to see some challenges with Brexit, the UK leaving the European Union. There's lots of trade issues around the world, and for us to put our head in the sand or somewhere else and just ignore trade as an opportunity and an absolute requirement to be successful in business and agriculture and manufacturing in this country is pretty darn naive.
You guys know my wife and I are recently back from France, but one of the things that may be part and parcel of all this, I mean, there's this growing sense of isolationism and fear of internationalism, not just in the United States. You find it in France, you find it in Germany, throughout Europe. How much of that is fueling this rhetoric?
Well, I would say there's a fair amount of that, but just look at South America, for instance. One country that didn't go along with a protectionist, you know, position there is Chile. They're doing phenomenal. And look at where the other countries are. They're all struggling. And so it's you know, we're at a point where it's a global economy and we can't move away from that. So, you know, there are perfect examples of what will happen if you do.
We have to export. It's I think around the United States in agriculture, we say it's one out of every three rows of everything we grow has to be exported somewhere. And certainly in the livestock industry, it's a big chunk, 40, 50, 60% in some cases. If we don't export, the devastation to our agricultural economy and the economy of the United States We aren't going to be buying pickups, not going to be buying farm equipment, not going to be buying all this stuff that farmers buy. As I love to say, if a farmer has a buck, he'll spend two. The challenge is, if we can't spend that money, if we can't grow the economy with agriculture, it does affect every other segment of the United States economy.
Well, speaking of other segments of the economy, the automotive companies just came out with their quarterly reports, and a large part of their profitability was in the international markets. I mean, there must be some allies. You know, manufacturing notwithstanding, you must have allies in the business and manufacturing community that agree that trade is a good thing.
Well, the frustration is, if you look at the big three, the reason they're building cars in Mexico and building cars in China and building cars in other countries is all of a sudden population in those countries is demanding automobiles and demanding motorized transportation. We've been there for a long time. Here, our demand is relatively stagnant to down. But around the world, it is a growing economy, and that's why some of those jobs have to be there. I was actually on a flight with a couple engineers from a couple major big three automotive companies, and they're talking about the automobiles and trucks that they build in Mexico are being used in Mexico and purchased in Mexico. Sure, some of them come back here. Some of our stuff goes there. That's the beauty of trade.
And again, I would add that worldwide demand is really what's driving our industry, the pork industry. If you look at the fact that we are now seeing a brand new $255 million pork processing facility built in Coldwater, Michigan, it's primarily to supply the export market. And so, you know, there's a lot of opportunities there. And with that $255 million investment comes about 1,000 jobs.
We're talking about the importance of international trade deals with Sam Hines, Executive Vice President of the Michigan Pork Producers Association, and Jim Byram, who's President of the Michigan Agribusiness Association. Well, gentlemen, now that the election is over with, I would imagine that agricultural interests are going to do a, well, let's use a basketball analogy, maybe a full court press. I mean, where are our senators with respect to this whole issue? I mean, what are the next steps for agriculture?
Take a deep breath. Create a reasonable strategy, as you say, a full court press. There's a lot of folks in Congress, in the Senate, and the House that want to support trade agreements, that want to support TPP. I mean, there's the rhetoric of the election is over. Let's get back to what makes common sense and reasonable sense to help grow the economy. Sure, every agricultural group under the sun and many that are maybe not under the sun are going to be in D.C. trying to encourage Congress to move the TPP. I assume the president will be presenting that very, very soon to Congress for a vote, an up or down vote. We are fully supportive, as is every agricultural group I know of. There may be nuances. Part of the art of compromise is you never get everything you want. So there's going to be things in there that maybe we don't like, maybe Sam doesn't like, maybe others don't like, but the growth and the opportunity for more and more trade and more growth in the economy is pretty profound with that agreement.
Well, I would just add, I mean, and we've already mentioned it, trade is critical to agriculture. And I would reemphasize that as we've looked at this, it's the largest commercial opportunity ever for the pork industry. So, yes, we are going to be pressing pretty hard just for passage of TPP.
For those listeners out there who may not be very well steeped in the agricultural industry, I mean, what are some take-home messages with respect to these trade deals that would have a direct impact on people listening to this radio program who basically go to the supermarket and buy their food there?
Let me give you a real simple example. We have we export several hundred thousand hundredweight of black beans to Mexico every year. Out of that, with that production, that means that farmers have to grow them, so we have to buy all the inputs to produce them and all the trucks that bring all that material to the farms to produce that, those black beans. Then we have to haul the black beans to a port. Then they go on a rail car. They go on a rail car, and they're hauled to Mexico. All that equipment is built by somebody. All that railroad infrastructure is supported by somebody. All those highways are built and supported by somebody. It is a wide-ranging impact on the economy. And that's just one little commodity that we have been able to sell to Mexico because of NAFTA and because of longstanding relationships. And there are hundreds of other examples that are even more profound, such as Sam's industry.
Well, again, going back to NAFTA, we were a net importer of pork in the U.S. before the trade agreement started. And interestingly, right now, we have trade agreements with 20 countries around the world, and we export more pork to those 20 nations than all the other nations combined. So, yes, what Jim says is it's critical to agriculture. It's critical, extremely critical to the pork industry.
We've got about a minute left, but I always like to bring up Cuba. I mean, Americans can get to Cuba relatively easily these days. I know, Jim, you've been to Cuba. Sam, I'm not sure if you've been down there at this point, but there are still restrictions on trade. I mean, these are restrictions that are steeped in history, that are antiquated. I mean, an example of what Congress could do to open up trade right off our shores.
Well, simply eliminate the requirement that trade be paid for in cash in advance. That would be a huge piece toward easing normalization of trade relationships. You know, a lot of folks talk about Cuba as, oh, gee, you know, the evil empire, whatever, how some may view it. But consider that we trade with China every day, one of our largest trading partners. Vietnam, we trade with Vietnam every day. Korea, we do lots of things around the world with countries that we may have had conflicts with in the past. Continuing to do the same thing repeatedly and expecting a different result is the definition of insanity. For 50 years, we've had an embargo in Cuba. It hasn't worked. Let's get beyond it. Let's be adults and let's open up trade. They're 90 miles off our shore. There's opportunities there. Let's make sure we take advantage of them at the same time, help the Cuban people improve their standard of living.
Well, we haven't specifically analyzed that market, but I can say they're huge pork consumers, so I'm sure it would be an asset to us.
Well, gentlemen, best of luck going forward with this full court pressure that we've talked about, the full court press. Maybe we can get you guys back in here in a few months with some positive developments to report.
Great. Appreciate the opportunity, and thanks for the show.
Well, I would just say thanks as well.
I've been talking with Sam Hines, Executive Vice President of the Michigan Pork Producers Association, Jim Byram, President of the Michigan Agribusiness Association. The importance of international trade, the success that NAFTA has had for Michigan agriculture and agriculture in general, and the growing importance of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Let's see what happens with that. Let's hope that in their infinite wisdom, Congress will get that deal done.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment. This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis with Larry Ponaroff. Larry is the new dean of the MSU College of Law.
It's great to have the new MSU College of Law Dean Lawrence Ponaroff join us. Welcome. It's great to have you on the show and look forward to this conversation.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
The Michigan State grew up a little bit when the law school came on campus. Talk about a little bit the perspective that you have of the law school on a bigger campus environment and what that means for the law school.
I've been at many law schools. I've had difficulty holding a job, but they've always been parts of major universities. To me, that's a very important aspect of a law school that I would be interested in, is to be part of a larger campus. What really attracted me to this position is the situation here is unique in that, in many ways, this is a brand new law school. Mm-hmm. The ink on the last MOU, which fully integrated us academically into the university, is barely 5 years old. And that presents the potential for lots of opportunities, a high ceiling. I think we've only begun to scratch the surface in terms of really leveraging the MSU brand. But unlike a brand new law school, we have a 125-year-old tradition, right, having educated four generations of leaders in law, business, and politics in Michigan and beyond.
Right. The opportunity to collaborate on this campus are immense if you take advantage of those opportunities. And I would suspect that your faculty, your students, get that opportunity with a multitude of different curriculum and activities across our campus.
Well, absolutely. And we'd also like to see additional collaboration both on the faculty and student level. In terms of our educational product, there's very few problems that are purely legal problems.
Right.
There are always dimensions to that problem that call on the expertise of different disciplines. So having an appreciation for whether it's psychology or business, and able to recognize that in addressing and trying to solve a client's particular problem, it's not just the black letter legal rule, but the broader gestalt that has to be explored is important. So we want our students out in appropriate courses around campus.
In some ways, you would correlate that with medical school and what physicians go through as they're training to become doctors. Much of that process is not just how to treat illness or to correct injuries. It's to learn how to cope, how to talk, how to be with people and socialize.
I think that's exactly right. We have a trial practice institute where a mandatory course is theatrics.
If you think about law schools and law school curriculum, and as your alums tell me, you know, the sort of constitutional law torts, there's a part of the curriculum that over the 125 years, if you would look at the names of the courses, probably hasn't changed
right.
a lot. But what are the biggest changes for law schools as you try to think about the 21st century? What are the big things on the horizon?
Some things are exactly the same as they were in 1890, but there have been changes. I think the biggest change that I've witnessed over my career, when I went to law school, basically law school was a graduate liberal arts education. And after all, law is one of the original humanities. But there was really no expectation either in the law school that they would teach you how to practice law or in the profession that you would graduate with any of those skills. There is an enormous amount now of pressure on us to be more applied in our educational program because there is a much greater expectation in the market that our students, our graduates, are going to be able to hit the ground running. So the advent of clinical education, simulation courses, the widespread use of adjunct faculty, practicing lawyers and sitting judges, because what do most of us know about practicing law anymore, is a real change. On the other hand, we don't want to lose. We don't want to just produce able technicians. We do want our students to graduate with critical thinking skills, the ability to reason analytically, to engage with the world in an almost classic liberal arts sense. And if we don't continue to do that, we don't do them, the profession, or society much good.
And how do you think about that in the context of specialization, sports law, Native American law, other things that the law schools have added along the way?
Yeah, it is certainly the case, as you well know, that law schools have developed specialty curricula, almost like majoring in environmental law or majoring in intellectual property law. And yet, the reality is that law school still is a generalist education. The whole first year is mandatory courses, the torts and constitutional law that you mentioned. Then there are a goodly number of upper-level courses that virtually every law student does and should take. That leaves very few blanks on the dance card for those specialty electives. So really, our certificate programs are structured ways of advising students, but really a student who wants a deep specialization in an area will typically go on to a LLM program, a master's in law program, or develop that expertise in the practice.
Or essentially get a joint master's law degree while they're at Michigan State.
That's right. And we have several joint degree programs, and we've just recently changed our message to our applicant base, saying we have these programs in place, but in addition to that, if you have an interest in doing a master's program while you're here, even a PhD program, and we don't have that program, just tell us what it is you want, and we'll make it up for you.
When the transition was made initially with then the Detroit College of Law to the campus, that list was a list that was what the students wanted to do, not what the faculty thought the students should do in terms
right.
of the master's degree programs. It reflected that, and as with many things, things get cemented in place over time.
Right.
And put in brochures and other things as being the only things yeah. that people can do, not just as an illustrative set. So I think the communication was really important, because the idea, I think, in this collaboration now, this more full integration after the last 5 years, is really to have a law school with very permeable boundaries
right.
between the law school and the university, which is not typical of law schools, particularly very highly ranked law schools. And we wanted to shift that culture some as we made this change. But it's always interesting how things get into a list, and they're very hard to change once they're into the list.
Well, it's always, you always have to watch out that the reason you do something a particular way is that's how you've always done it, and be reexamining it constantly. And I think you're right. Historically, law schools tended to be silos, even law schools that were right on campus. And,
right.
you know, what an enormous waste of the resources that are around you.
Now, law school applications across the country have been declining, and law firms are hiring fewer people. There's a sort of a tough, by some students' definition, job market. And these are all known now because everybody has all this information on their phones. And it's a little bit reminiscent of my experience with engineers. Mm-hmm. You know, I've sort of gone the cycle of engineers are the most valuable thing in the world. Well, you know, maybe they're not so valuable. Maybe it's really a business student with a technical sort of minor. That's what we really want. And now, you know, the world says we can't get enough engineers. So I'm sure part of this is cyclical. But what would you say to somebody in our listening audience who have students entering college now, students who may be nearing graduation from college, about why it's really a good investment to think about law school?
I think the important message there, law schools used to be default programs for smart kids who didn't know what they wanted to do with their lives. I think we're all too expensive to indulge that attitude of falling into law school. But by the same token, I often, when I'm talking to undergraduates that are considering law school, first I say, make sure this is a serious commitment on your part, mm-hmm. Because it is a big investment of time and money, and it is a tough market. But I have, over... the 12, 13 years now as a dean, run into scores of alumni who are not in the traditional practice of law. Some never were. Some moved out of it. And they're real estate developers, and they're investment bankers, and they're corporate managers. One of them is the general manager of the Miami Dolphins, right. actually. Had been the Jets. Was a former student. But every one of them, to a person, tells me that he or she believes they are better off in whatever their chosen profession is for the skills that they acquired in law school. So I think that is an important message to prospective students, to recognize that there is value to a legal education beyond the traditional practice of law. And it's something in a difficult job market, and it is, that our students need to be thinking about. They can put, as long as we do our job right, they can put their education to work and get value from it in a lot of different ways.
And partly in the sense of that's why you do some minors or potentially some joint degrees, but it is this process to think and adapt and be able to think about both rules of law, as it often says, and context,
mm-hmm.
and put those together very, very effectively. And most business decisions, most life decisions in your companies come from that combination of of some parameters of rules and some and context and how you can put them together in the best way. But rankings and ratings are really only reflecting now those traditional law jobs.
That's right.
I mean, which is one of the – so if you're a place like us and you see this as a broader humanities graduate program with these specialized skills in environment or entrepreneurship, intellectual property, other things, and you go off and you essentially work in a startup company as one of their team – it doesn't count now in terms of as you're employed, but
right.
The way in which the,
discounted it's in the weighting.
That job is discounted in the weighting of jobs. And it's really one of the more interesting parts of the way in which law schools are considered, because there is this, which was one of the surprises to me in encountering law schools, is that there is this fundamental philosophy about the value of it and how it can be applicable across a startup company, General Motors, a law firm, a federal regulatory agency, USDA, in terms of have people who are doing regulatory issues that sure. are not necessarily the lawyer for the USDA. We have a person who's and then we have people who are the legal counsel for McDonald's. I mean, so you have all these variations of jobs, but in rankings and ratings, only the most traditional count.
Yeah.
And it's really I find it really an interesting way of the profession both talking about itself and at the same time using rating themselves in terms of the traditional ways.
Well, I guess it's just another example of no good deed goes unpunished because
I think. Do you use that line too?
all the time. I do believe that by making our graduates good citizens and able to be successful and effective in whatever we do, we're doing them a great service. But from a pure rankings point of view, that's not the direction we should be taking.
Well, and I also think that if you look at how this generation of students in particular appears to be more concerned about lifestyle balances along the way. Some of the traditional ways in which young lawyers are introduced into law firms and the way in which compensation is structured mm-hmm. is in some ways a very interesting cultural tension with, let's say, particularly young people who are already invested 3 years in graduate school after four or five in the undergraduate, and now they're getting to their 30s, near 30, right. and they're thinking about lifestyle, families, a whole range of things. And there's the traditional process of law school, legal firms is just very different for that junior lawyer in terms of hours, expectations, and some other things. And so I think when I talk to students and they think about being a lawyer, they think about it in that context, mm-hmm. not the broader ways in which law as a area of study is applicable to all of these other things.
Well, I think that's right, and it's still true. If you want that high-paying, big city, big firm job, they're available, and they're going to pay you that big salary, but they're also going to get it out of you, which means that they're going to have very high expectations of the amount of time that you're going to devote to the firm. And as you say, almost sociologically, this is a generation that is much more sensitive to that work-life style balance. So I hear from alumni all the time, your graduates don't want to work hard enough. I said, maybe you ought to live a little bit, but be that it may, it's a tension. But you also students need to be self-aware. And it's fine to want that, but then don't put yourself in a position where you're not going to get that. And that's part of our responsibility in how we counsel our students with respect to their career path.
The case study method, the classroom method, is also very much a part of the teaching of law with now instead of going to the library, I have the books on my computer. So how do you think, you know, not necessarily now, but also in the future, that this sort of technology-rich environment can distinguish MSU Law?
Well, I think there's potentially a number of opportunities. We have a program right now called Legal Research and Development, Legal R&D, which looks at the changing way in which legal services are delivered, and the most important component of that is the disruptive effect of technology, whether it's robo-lawyer for an individual who wants to create a will, or it's a huge corporation in litigation doing e-discovery where an algorithm is going to go through millions of documents in a very short period of time. Lawyers tend to be Luddites, so it's very important to us that we have our students not only prepared with respect to the doctrine, but also prepared to be effective in the next generation of delivery of legal services, which means to be appropriately savvy in technology. And we have a significant amount of instructional technology being used in the classroom right now, not so much by me, but certainly by my younger colleagues.
I was going to say, there is a generation gap.
I wanted to take technology just in a different approach, social media, social issues.
Yes.
Being discussed on national platforms, sports, there's quite a bit of it, medical industry, quite a bit of it. Even during an election year, social media is used in a variety of ways. How is the law profession? I mean, everyone is having to cope with this technology change. How is the law profession coping with having social issues discussed on an open platform, which I think there's good and bad, and how you teach in the classroom of how to deal with that technology change?
Well, you know, it's a great question, and it's also very tricky in the legal profession, because of the paramount importance of client confidentiality.
Right.
You have, you know, young people now who are coming to law school who are accustomed to just tweeting out everything or posting everything on their Facebook, and we need to acculturate them that there are, once you're in the profession, there are certain things that are appropriate and certain things that are not. And by the way, you're never going to get in the profession if there's some things on your Facebook site that are not appropriate. On the other hand, I do think that the opportunity for interchange through blogs and continuing legal education can play a valuable role for a practicing lawyer. You no longer need to fly to a particular city and sign up for a 3-day conference in order to get specialized education in your field. You can get it sitting right at your computer, and as a consequence of that, be more efficient and effective in your practice.
So we're going to leave with the question of, so what's been your biggest surprise coming to Michigan State, since you're the new kid on the block?
I don't know. Surprised about, because it was really part of the attraction of coming here in the first place. And I know this may sound a little corny, but I really feel this sincerely. And that is how genuinely warm and open and welcoming people have been. I mean, not a surprise, but an expectation that I'm glad to see fulfilled.
Thank you very much, Larry.
Thank you.
That was Lawrence Ponderoff, the new dean of the MSU College of Law, talking with Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis. To hear the conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com. This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Tune to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Well, we talk a lot on this program about the importance of efficiency as we look to a better energy future, but we don't often drill down and discuss specific steps that homeowners can take. Well, with winter coming on, let's talk to someone who can guide us. He is Lou Blessing. He's the owner of the Blessing Company, which is an award-winning plumbing, heating, and cooling services business based in Grand Blanc, Michigan. Lou, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Lou, let's talk a little bit before we get into some of these tips, a little bit about your company.
Well, my dad started the business back in 1946 in Grand Blanc after he got out of the service, served in World War One. And this year we're actually celebrating our 70th year in business.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that you are a proud alum of Michigan State University in building construction.
That's correct, yep. I was here from 72 to 76.
Well, go green on that.
And go white.
But let's talk about some tips. Again, like I said, we talk energy efficiency in the broad sense on this program. But what are some things that homeowners can do with winter coming on to really improve their energy use?
Okay, well, the first thing is that if you're going to go through the winter with your current furnace, you really should have it inspected, have a safety check done on it, have it cleaned, and just make sure it's ready for the winter. Make sure you change your filter. Mm-hmm. We see a lot of homeowners that are neglecting that these days. They don't think about it, and they don't change their filters, and that really restricts the airflow on the furnace.
Let me come back to that one, because I've had this experience myself. When you have someone like the Blessing Company come in and check your furnace, can you change the filter, or is that something that the homeowner has to do, or does that have to be worked out ahead of time?
Really worked out ahead of time. Mm-hmm. There are so many different filter sizes, and like on our service vans, we carry probably about 12 different sizes, but we can't carry them all.
Right.
So you just have to work it out with the homeowner. Who's going to change it?
And if you know ahead of time what type of furnace it is and what have you, then you can have the filter in the truck kind of thing.
Yep, we'll bring it along. Yep.
Okay, what are some other things besides the annual checkup of the furnace?
Well, I would consider having your ductwork cleaned. Mm. If you've never had it cleaned before, we do duct cleaning, and it's amazing what we get out of the duct systems. And just for a better indoor air quality, you know, you can get that years of buildup of dust out of the ductwork. Primarily the return air is where the buildup really is. And the other thing is consider having the ductwork sealed and to have a professional come in and seal it. There's a couple of different ways you can do it, and that will give you a lot better air delivery throughout the house.
Is that like the furnace, is the ductwork cleaning an annual event, or is that something that maybe can be done every other year type?
Now, ductwork cleaning, you maybe would only do that once every 10 to 20 years, not very often.
Lou, you folks are a factory licensed dealer for Carrier, factory authorized dealer for Carrier products. What about this whole business of Energy Star furnaces and Energy Star appliances? A lot of people hear those and see the sticker, but they maybe don't really realize what they're reading.
Well, the Energy Star, to qualify for Energy Star, you have to meet certain efficiencies on your furnaces. And the other thing that ties into Energy Star appliances is almost all the utilities in Michigan now offer utility rebates when you're purchasing new equipment. And the equipment has to reach certain efficiencies. On furnaces, it's 94% efficient.
Okay.
So if you're considering buying a new furnace, look for the Energy Star logo, but also check the efficiency rating on that furnace, because if it's over 94% efficient, you're going to get a rebate from your utility company, help pay for it.
Now, what does that number mean exactly, 94% efficient or better?
94% efficient is the gas burning efficiency.
Okay.
So, I mean, the way we explain it, for every dollar's worth of gas you buy, you're going to get 94 cents worth of heat coming into your home.
Ah, so cost-benefit analysis is basically what it is.
Right. You take in the old furnaces, the old standard furnaces, we're 50 to 60% efficient, so somewhere between 40 and 50% of your gas is going right up the chimney.
Lou, we're talking about heating and winter coming on and ductwork and all that, but let's not neglect the cooling part. That means the air conditioning is probably going to be shut down for a while. What do people need to do with respect to the cooling side of the equation?
Well, what you need to do, of course, is set your thermostat to heat. And I would recommend you cover the condenser outside. And it just keeps the weather out of it, the leaves, the snow, the ice, it'll add some years to that condenser outside if you could cover it. And you can buy, there's a couple companies that manufacture covers. You could call your HVAC contractor, and all you need is your model and serial number of your air conditioner, and they'll make it to fit it. Or you can just cover it with some plastic.
Now, you got, let's say you've got this 94% efficient furnace, and you've got all the right equipment, but there's some things you can do in your home, too, that will maximize the use of that heat once it comes out of the furnace.
Oh, yeah. What we like to tell our customers to do is run the fan constantly in their home so that you're always circulating some air in the home. And the new furnaces today, the fans, the motors on the furnaces are so efficient that it costs you pennies a day. And our analogy is comparing it to an old standard furnace, a new furnace with a ECM motor, which is a DC current motor. It's going to cost you about $45 a year to run it. And on an AC motor on a furnace, it's going to cost you about $45 a month. Right. So it's costing you hardly anything. And these ECM motors improve the comfort level in your home tremendously. It'll make it, I don't know if you've ever lived in a home with hot water heat, it's going to make your home that has forced air in it almost as comfortable as a home with hot water heat in it.
And what about some of the things we hear about in terms of insulation and weather stripping and things of that nature? Also important?
Very important. And there again, there's the utility companies have some great programs for making your homes more efficient. And these are things that everybody should look at. Is go to your utility website. They have comprehensive programs with different measures, which are different improvements you can make to your home, and you'll get rebates on each of these measures. The only thing you have to do to qualify is you have to have a home energy audit performed, which is an assessment of your home and how efficient the home is. And you'll get a full report from that auditor as to telling you what to do and how much leakage your house has.
And again, back to what you said earlier, because that's one of the things that you folks do. Make sure you get that that furnace checked every year by a company like the Blessing Company. I've been talking about energy efficiency and preparing for the winter with Lou Blessing. Lou is the owner of the Blessing Company. It's an award-winning plumbing, heating, and cooling services business. They're based in Grand Blanc, Michigan. They service all of Genesee County. They're also a factory-authorized dealer for Carrier products. Lou, a pleasure having you on the program.
Thank you. It was great being here.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment. WKAR.
I'm Scott Westerman from the Michigan State University Alumni Association, with another observation from The Spartan Life. One of the regrets I have about the intensity of my great gig at MSU is that I don't have nearly the time I would like to spend with people who want to talk with me about career advice in person. I always start by guiding them to our superb MSUAA Alumni Career Services team. Our approach is a lot different than the resume polishers many of us may have experienced in the past. It's all about figuring out what you love and building a personal toolbox to help you get paid for doing it. On the occasions where it's impossible for me to sync up my schedule for a one-on-one, I share the high points in an email. And here they are. Number one, discover your passion. Life is always much more fun if you're doing something you love. Number two, pick your company carefully. Too many people jump into cultures that are totally out of sync with who they are. To paraphrase Jim Collins in Good to Great, first where, then what? What are your top five favorite companies? Why? How could you add value there? Number three, draw a map. Stephen Covey says, begin with the end in mind. Where do you want to be 10 years from now? The more detailed a picture you can paint of your current ultimate objective, the easier it will be to design a roadmap to get you there. to follow up on picking your company carefully, which organizations might have your dream job? Where are the entry points for your dream career? What are the steps others have taken to get where you want to go? Assess your assets is number 4. Once you know what makes you happy, it's a lot easier to aim toward that end. How have you prepared for that life? Are there any additional skills you need? How will you create and promote your personal brand? Number 5, build a productive network. Connect with people who are already where you want to be. LinkedIn's power isn't in the quantity of people in your network. It's the quality. One of the best things about LinkedIn's search functionality is how you can parse your network for the companies and job types you're interested in, and then seek Spartans who already work in these places. These are the connections that will be the most important to you. Read Keith Ferrazzi's Never Eat Alone. It's not only the best networking book on the market, it's the best relationship book out there. Number 6, add value before you are hired. Too many people ask me to help them find a job. In fact, we hire solutions and ideas, not people. If you have identified a company where you want to work, study it thoroughly. What are their strengths and weaknesses? Who are their competitors? What is their biggest current challenge? Think of ways you can help them overcome their problems and grow more successful. Imagine that you are a consultant and have been hired to help them grow the business. What would you recommend? How would you implement your idea? What would it cost? What resources would it require? If you've done this exercise, your career conversations will be much more fruitful. This is being proactive, and it pays off. And what if the job you want doesn't exist yet? A growing percentage of our graduates are working in positions that weren't around 5 years ago. Some even discovered that their research reveals an opportunity to create their own gig. Don't be afraid to create yours. Be professionally persistent. You will likely get rejected a number of times before someone realizes your value. That's okay. Keep in touch with the people you meet who work where you want to work. Share helpful links and productive ideas with them from time to time. Don't swamp them with email, but share ideas of real value when you find them. If you have been able to learn about their interests outside of work, seek ways to help them improve the quality of their lives. We tend to be attracted to people who genuinely care about us as individuals. We are repelled by pests. Keep the faith. This is the most important thing. If you maintain a focus on your objective, listen and act on the feedback you receive, build a productive network, and find ways to add value, you will inevitably get the job you seek. Never lose your capacity for hope. So ponder these points. You'll be able to ask the "Can you help me?" question much more effectively. When you get that face-to-face with an advisor or mentor, the conversation will be much more productive. And in the end, you'll discover that the question isn't, "Can you help me?" It's, "How can I help you?" I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Learn more about Spartans Helping Spartans at alumni.msu.edu.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear this show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.